Hey, y'all. I'm Erin Haynes, the host of The Amendment, a brand new weekly podcast on gender, politics, and power brought to you by the 19th News and Wonder Media Network. You've probably heard the news that this election year, our democracy is at stake. On The Amendment, I'm breaking down what that actually means, specifically for the marginalized folks who depend on our democracy the most. This is a show that dives past the headlines and gets clear on the unfinished work of our democracy. Listen to The Amendment now, wherever you get your podcasts.
From the McCourtney Institute for Democracy on the campus of Penn State University, I'm Michael Berkman.
I'm Candace Watt-Smith.
I'm Jenna Spinelli, and welcome to Democracy Works! This week we are talking with Heather McGee, formerly of the think tank Demos, and the author of the book The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. Heather spoke at Penn State recently as part of a lecture series from our colleagues in the Rock Ethics Institute. And this book has been out for a while. I'm sure the title will be familiar to many of our listeners. But I think the lesson she gives in her story certainly are worth sharing today. And I think that we all thought a bit about our conversation with Rihanna Gunright. I'll link in the show notes if you haven't listened to that. But there are definitely some similarities between the paths that Rihanna and Heather took to the work that they're doing.
Just to remind people, Rihanna Gunright is a climate activist who worked on the Green New Deal. And she talked about how her, you know, the physical experience of growing up in an area where there were no parks and where things were obviously not maintained and just being exposed to sort of inequities in climate and environment propelled her into the kind of activist work she did in terms of climate change and environmentalism. See a very similar thing with Heather McGee in talking about the economic situation in which she grew up and in that she saw. What also strikes me about each of them is how they went so deeply in their careers and in their writing into thinking about policy and the importance of public policy and what we can learn by really studying public policy closely.
Yeah, I would also say, and I think Heather McGee does a really great job of really pinpointing the ways in which our common sense needs to be troubled and to kind of unpack both the patterns that we see at a particular moment in time. And then by expanding through history, we see that the thing that we have become very used to, that we talk to as if it's always been that way, it hasn't. And that there are other moments in history where we had opportunities to broaden a social safety net, where we had a kind of orientation toward what the government is supposed to do, toward, you know, whose votes mattered. And of course, you know, not to romanticize the era before civil rights, but there are things that she picks up on about what we think, you know, what an average American thought the government should do. And that just because someone, hold on, let me say this, not to romanticize pre-civil rights era, but there are things that she notes that Americans had a different common sense about what the government owed to its citizens and what its responsibility was to its citizens in a way that we don't think about now. And I think similarly, and not to just keep drawing a parallel between her and Rihanna, but like the Green New Deal suggests that we could think differently. And Heather McGee's work shows that there are moments in time when we have very different orientations towards questions of democracy, of economics, of labor, of well-being, of social welfare policies, and so on.
Yeah, but even with that, I mean, as I read her and listen to her, I hear her saying that even though there were periods of time where we thought more in community terms, more in ways that government can act in everybody's interest, racism still was pervasive in the development
absolutely.
Of public policies.
Totally.
And so even if you look at these periods where I think you would say that there was this sort of sentiment among the public, the New Deal or the Great Society during the 1960s, each of those, you know, public policy was really structured by racial politics and by out and out racism. But she really does a wonderful job throughout the book of developing this idea of these big grand public pools that at one point represented this sort of communal interest in, you know, providing something for everybody in the community, but they were segregated. And when they had to be desegregated, they were filled in instead. And that her central point here with this metaphor is to say that, you know, we can't have nice things because if Black people are going to be involved too, then we may as well take it away from everybody.
Right. The other
Not
part
worth
of
having.
It is that we could have very well turned left instead of right.
Yes.
And my students would not be surprised by the fact that beautiful pools existed for the public, that the government cared enough to build these things for average yes. citizens to enjoy for free.
Yeah. Yes.
And there's certainly a pattern here, too, of I'm thinking about, you know, the episode we did with Derek Black on public schools. Mm-hmm. We've covered this, you know, erosion of public goods and the why can't we have nice things, or this is why we can't have nice things in several ways on the show previously.
Yeah.
So I think one thing to just pull out there is that this strategy to segregate schools by privatizing mm-hmm. is has almost become just kind of a way that we do things.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at the politics around voucher systems, for example, or creating or not creating public parks, or we can go on and on, or even about like giving states power over Medicaid and TANF, these things were all rooted in racist strategies to prevent the dismantling of Jim Crow racial segregation and hierarchy. But over time, we have just gotten, many people have gotten caught up in the, this is just how things are done. Without knowing the background of it, we kind of move through life as if this is the way that we just do things. And so what I appreciated about the Sum of Us and Heather McGee's work is to show that the patterns that we see, the policies that we see that seem so common sense. Yeah, a voucher program makes sense. We don't like public schools. Let's just give the money to parents to go to private school. We've seen that before to uphold a racial, a racist society.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't use that rationale anymore, but they often tend to have the same effects.
Yeah.
So really just kind of shining a light on the history so that we can see how these patterns reemerge, even under different auspices, right, to the same ramifications.
And she also does a nice job of showing ways that these now familiar patterns are being broken in some ways larger than others and in certainly some isolated cases. But I think she also makes the case, as you'll hear in the interview, that this is all, you know, a broader scale change is within our reach. We're just stuck in a failure of imagination right now. So I know both of you have more to say about Heather's work and this book, but let's go now to the interview. Heather McGee, welcome to Democracy Works. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So I'd like to start, before we talk about some of your work, with some of the experiences that maybe helped form your political identity and some of the perspectives that you bring to the work that you do. You write about, you know, growing up in an all-Black neighborhood and then going to a predominantly white boarding school and then coming of age politically in the 90s and the era of maybe peak neoliberalism and those sorts of things. I wonder if you could just give our listeners an introduction to some of those events and how they have shaped the way that you think about race and economics and politics.
Well, I'm happy to. So I grew up on the south side of Chicago in the 1980s in a time where that very thick working and middle class Black neighborhood was really under siege. And it was the beginning of what would be the sort of dismantling of the kind of pillars of solid family life and economic life there between the deindustrialization that caused so many factory closings, the budget cuts where there were so many public sector workers in the Black community because historical discrimination had sort of, you know, been rendered illegal there first before the private sector. And I was the kind of kid growing up who would ask a lot of why questions. I know because I now have that kind of kid myself. And I was lucky because my parents were the kind of parents who would give me systemic answers and political answers and have me think deeper about, frankly, the narratives that we were seeing in the media. By the time I was a teenager, it was the era of the welfare reform debates. And, you know, a lot of the conversation was about, you know, kind of neighborhoods like mine and families like mine and my families and my families like mine and my friends being the problem, you know, Black single mothers and all of that. And I just didn't buy it. It really didn't track with what I saw in my community, which is if you're going to bet on anybody in the world, you should be betting on a Black single mother to be able to save the world and make blood out of a turnip and all of that. And so I was agitated as a young, you know, as a teenager, and I was interested in public policy. I was interested in the economy. I was interested in figuring out who was making decisions that was making it easier or harder for some families to get ahead. And I wanted to be at the table. And so I was lucky to get an entry-level job at an economic and democracy think tank when I was 22 years old.
Yeah. And this is a very broad question, but you know what you just said there, I'm interested to see where it takes us. How do you think about the relationship between economics and democracy, and how has that maybe changed over time?
Yeah. I mean, this was a big question. It was a strategic question for my organization, Demos. We were founded on the idea that inequality in our democracy and our economy were inextricably linked. And it was sort of an intellectual pursuit of the founders of the organization to figure out kind of really what that meant and how you saw evidence of it in the day-to-day. And by the time I was in leadership of the organization, we'd really figured out by using some wonderful research by political scientists that there is a real feedback loop, that the economic inequality that's created by the class gaps in turnout and in voting, as well as, of course, the system of money in politics, have really verifiable effects on the decisions that our lawmakers make. And so people like Larry Bertels and Ben Page, these are political scientists who did research in the mid-2000s, late 2000s, first decade of the 2000s, really showing that the more money you had, the more impact you had, and that the donor class as a whole had an incredible policy return on their investments in the political system, whereas, for example, the lowest third of the income distribution had no independent ability to change policy at all, right, if it didn't align with wealthier people's interests. And so that helped to explain a lot of the economic policymaking that was going on in a bipartisan fashion at this time, that was really allowing the minimum wage to stagnate, that was continuing to pursue a trade policy that benefited multinational corporations and decimated workers, that was willing to see unions stay under attack and not update labor laws, and on and on and on. And of course, most importantly, to keep taxes on the wealthy extremely low by historical terms and by comparative terms.
Yeah, and so to take that and bring in what is a key part of the thesis from your book, The Sum of Us, how does the idea of the zero-sum mentality that you describe in the book fit with this picture you've just articulated?
Well, I really felt, I have to say, once we had kind of been able to do a big kind of signature report at Demos that laid out the relationship between inequality and democracy in our economy, I felt like we had really, we'd figured it out, right? This report was called Stack Deck. It was really well designed. We had this great graphic designer. We did a lot of donor briefings to foundations and people who fund nonprofits like ours. We did lots of legislative testimony and presentation on it. It just felt like, okay, we figured out the whole darn system, you know? But there was this sort of nagging feeling for me, which was there's some part of this that's missing. And the part of this that's missing really in some ways goes back to the rhetoric that I grew up with, the political rhetoric that I grew up with, and how race had been this kind of silent actor in every single conversation about the scope and size of government that had ever happened in politics in my life, from Reagan to Clinton to, you know, Gingrich, and certainly through the Obama era, where, you know, research really demonstrates that the kind of figure of government in particularly the imagination of white voters became very racialized, and there became a new layer of voters' positions on issues that are not at first blush racial issues, but really economic issues, questions about the size and role of government, about social programs and who we are and who we are to one another and what people deserve, really became highly racialized. And the partisan structure became highly racialized. And there was sort of a splitting. It was like if you, I like to joke, it's like if you became someone who had more progressive, as we now think about it, policy ideas and more of a Democrat, basically if you liked the Obamas, would want to hang out with somebody like them, right? And if you didn't, if there was something about them that rubbed you the wrong way, then, you know, you became more conservative on things that maybe weren't that ideological previously. And that's a very kind of simplistic way of putting it, but at the same time, it's kind of true, right? You saw white voters, you know, move to the Democratic Party and become much more progressive on both economic issues, but also on racial issues. And this factor known as racial resentment, which is the idea, this sort of narrative that it is a zero sum, that progress for people of color is a threat to white people, has to come at their expense, that there's sort of just a fixed pie of well-being in the U.S. and you and your group need to get a bigger slice. And that will mean, yes, that other groups will get a smaller slice. That whole narrative, that story that says there's this hierarchy and we really need to sort of jealously guard our group's place in it, is one that became a lot louder in political discourse, particularly in conservative politics, in conservative talk radio. And this sort of zero sum, us versus them, it's not just about taxes, it's about America and who's in and who's out and our way of life. And this isn't just about healthcare, this is about, you know, destroying the American, you know, the American idea, right? That really began to reveal to me that there was something else going on, that race was a bigger actor. And so I set out on what would become a 3-year journey to find out what racism was costing us, the extent of racism in our politics and our policymaking, and that would end up becoming the book, The Sum of Us.
Yeah. So I want to pause on the Sum of Us story for a minute and talk a little bit about the world of think tanks and nonprofits. You mentioned that, you know, you had this big report from Demos and you gave presentations to foundations and people who fund nonprofits. And I wonder how much, you know, I'm thinking about the work of Anand Giridharadas and some others who sort of take aim at this nonprofit industrial complex, so to speak. And I guess I wonder, as someone who has been in that world, how much do you think that those structures impede progress on the issues that you are so diligently and passionately working on?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think that we need more civic engagement, more dollars going into institutions that are durable, that help everyday people get involved in our democracy, that help them see the connections between their problems and public solutions. And so I actually don't think that the quote-unquote nonprofit industrial complex is an impediment to a thriving democracy. And I've seen times when it's, you know, a few think tanks and a couple scholars on a phone call are the only thing, you know, keeping Wall Street reform intact, right? I've seen more often when think tanks' research and expertise is ignored at great consequence to our economy and to our society. So I actually don't really buy that, you know, if we just stopped letting wealthy foundations and individuals, you know, fund nonprofit organizations, things would be better. But I do think we need more of the other stuff, more grassroots citizen-funded organizations, more labor unions with strength, right, that are funded independently by working people with an agenda around working people. I think that's more of the problem than too much or nefarious kind of nonprofit think tank infrastructure.
Yeah. So to get back on track with the sum of us, there's this kind of parable of not a parable because it's true. It happened, the drain pool. For listeners who might not be familiar with that story, tell us what that is and how it ties back to that zero-sum idea you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. This really became sort of an obsession of mine on my journey to write The Sum of Us, which was a literal journey. I traveled uncounted, untallied miles across the country. And one of the things that I stumbled upon was this phenomenon of towns and cities that used to have lavish, well-funded, grand resort-style public swimming pools that were part of a building boom of public goods in the 1930s and 40s, part of the sort of New Deal era of public goods, both, you know, public roads, bridges, libraries, schools, pools, but also economic public goods like Social Security and a massive investment in housing, the GI Bill, right, the wage and hour and labor laws of the New Deal, right? All of these public goods helped to build this strong middle class, and in some ways the well-funded, beautiful, free public swimming pool was just kind of a glittering reflection of this good life, right? And what I discovered was that usually these public swimming pools were, for much of the 20th century, segregated, even in places like Pennsylvania and Boston and Chicago that you wouldn't normally think would have this kind of Jim Crow-style segregation, and that once communities, Black communities, communities of color, and their allies sued to integrate public swimming pools, many towns and cities across the country, not just in the Jim Crow South, were willing to destroy their public pools rather than integrate them. They would literally drain out the water, back up truckloads of dirt and gravel. And this phenomenon of the drained pool being a cost to the public of racism and the literal willingness to destroy something rather than share it, this zero-sum thinking that if it's not entirely mine, then if I share it, somehow that makes me worse off. Something good for you is worse off, makes me worse off. You know, that kind of thinking, which led to actual pool closures across the country, is something that political scientists also picked up in our politics in the wake of the civil rights movement. And you saw a massive ideological shift away from collective solutions, the kind of New Deal thinking about government's role in ensuring a decent standard of living for people, once the people included all the people, right? Not just the white majority. And so I do believe that that was a really important predicate, that integration and the resistance to integration, the triumph of zero-sum thinking over collectivism once the collective was truly multiracial was one of the predicates for the rise of neoliberalism, right? So if you drain the public pools, then you have private backyard pools, right? And so you began to see this shift from the New Deal kind of coalition among the majority of white voters that, of course, has remained today, right? The majority of white voters haven't voted for a Democrat for president since Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act.
Yeah, I mean, we see it in private schools, other spaces that used to have public things. We've talked on the show before that the library, the public library, may be one of the last kind of bastions of this, mm-hmm. although it too is facing its share of challenges. But the thinking was not always this way. You also cite some research and polling from the late 50s, early 60s, yeah. about the people used to have, even the kind of median white voter, mm-hmm. using air quotes, had much more radical views, mm-hmm. about what role the government should play in this notion of public goods.
That's right. That's exactly right. They're really, I mean, you can just think about kind of what the New Deal program was, the unfinished work of the New Deal. You know, FDR's second address, which said, you know, we need an economic bill of rights, and it was a guarantee of housing and all of that. And he was wildly popular with the majority of white voters. And there's a study, the ANES, that I cite in the book, which shows that almost 70% of white voters in 1956 and 1960 supported a federal job guarantee and a universal basic income. And that's kind of, you know, impossible to contemplate today, that 70% of white voters would be in that place. And by the time the 1964 poll was fielded, you'd really seen a sharp decline in support for those ideas of government having such a robust role. Once government began to go from being the enforcer of the racial hierarchy to the sometimes and often reluctant but upender of the racial hierarchy, right? And government began to be seen as a force that should be distrusted, right? And that, of course, became a part of the corporate class's agenda, their political agenda, to drive a wedge between white voters and the very idea of government, the very idea of public things, public schools, public solutions, taxes, regulation, etc. But of course, you know, the bottom line here is who really benefits from that drained pool of politics, right? White families don't get to swim in the public pool either, right? If you know, the only people who benefit are people who can go to country clubs, right? Which cropped up all over the country after in the wake of public pool integration, right? So it's that parable which really shows that it's really the wealthy and well-connected who benefit from a middle-class white voter being willing to go on their own instead of seek common solutions to their common problems with people who might be of different backgrounds.
Right. And I mean, there, you also give examples in the book of people who are seeking common solutions to common problems with people who are of different backgrounds. Tell us about the community of Lewiston, Maine, and what you observed there.
Yeah. So the third big idea in the book, beyond the zero sum racial thinking and the drained pool politics, is the idea that I end on. I end most of the chapters with a kind of hopeful example of something I call a solidarity dividend. And I actually I went on after the book was published to create a documentary style podcast also called The Sum of Us, which is exclusively about solidarity dividends, because I felt like, you know, we need to pay a lot more attention to this hopeful story that's happening in every corner of our country if you just look for it. And so the idea of a solidarity dividend is a gain that people can unlock, but only by coming together across lines of race. And Lewiston, Maine is one of the, you know, smaller cities in Maine, which is the whitest state in the nation. And it was a dying mill town, the same kind of town that, you know, most people are familiar with deindustrialization and population loss. And you began to see, you know, the diseases of despair and all of that. It was a familiar story of decline, of a, you know, almost entirely white small town. And what towns like that really need are new people, right, to stop the kind of circling of the drain. And that happened by an accident of history. But those new people in a very kind of inward-looking town ended up being African Muslim refugees and immigrants. And the stories of those everyday people from Maine who were white and who, you know, had very little in common on so many levels with folks who had fled from Sudan and the Congo, you know, and other places, really, I tell stories both in the book and in the podcast of white and African folks finding a way to help each other that can really address some of the things that are plaguing small towns, whether it's the loss of family farms, which I talk about in the podcast, or the very idea of loneliness and isolation, which is the example that I give in the book, as well as healthcare, because it was a real multiracial coalition anchored in the towns with more diverse New Mainers that was able to help win a ballot initiative in 2017, I believe, to win the Medicaid expansion that had been vetoed 5 times by a governor who used really racist rhetoric to justify cutting welfare. You know, it's like these illegals and these drug dealers are coming here for welfare, and so that's why we have to cut it. And of course, if you cut welfare in the state of Maine, which is over 90% white, you know, who's getting hurt, right? It was a very clear drain pool politics. But a multiracial coalition was able to unlock the solidarity dividend of better health in Maine.
Right. So to unlock those solidarity dividends, it seems to me you need both a culture where these, you know, cross-racial, maybe cross other kinds of divides can thrive, but you also need the structure to help enact that change. In some cases, it's a ballot measure. In some cases, it's things that happen at the local level. So how do you think about the interplay between culture and structure when it comes to making change?
Yeah, it's a really good question. As I'm sort of ticking through the solidarity dividend and blah, blah, blah. Hold on 1 second. That is a good question. As I'm sort of filing through the solidarity dividend examples in my head, a number of them were ballot initiatives, were multiracial coalitions that were able to provide democracy right to the people and sort of circumvent the powerful. And then I think of some examples where a community, where democracy, the structures of democracy made it very challenging, where you could have community organizing, which is what it really is at the heart of it, but, you know, you could have structures at the local level that were really resistant to change. And a couple of examples, the local leadership was the most resistant to change. And activists needed to go to the county or the state in order to win fairness and justice. So it's actually interesting. It's not a kind of obvious formula, one size fits all, but almost by definition, every single time people try to come together to change things at a significant scale, they have to interact with decision makers. They have to have some lever to pull. And we have a very complicated system, right? And so there are ways you can align it to make local people more powerful and to align our structures of democracy more towards justice and fairness. And then there are ways you can gum up the works and make it really hard for things to change for the better.
Yeah. So you say in the book that you are fundamentally a hopeful person. You certainly, as you've said here just today, you tell lots of hopeful stories. I wonder what's making you feel hopeful today, and maybe what's next for you? What is the next chapter of The Sum of Us, or what other projects you might be working on?
Thanks for the question. Yeah, I'm hopeful most of the time. I'm hopeful fundamentally because I know that decisions made the world that we are living in today, and better decisions can make a better world. I'm hopeful because I've had a discipline for the past number of years of really focusing on the overlooked stories in places, you know, that are themselves overlooked, in rural Maine and small town Nevada and, you know, Memphis, Tennessee, and, you know, coastal towns in California, places where, you know, everyday citizens are doing extraordinary work, where the energy of the summer of 2020, which saw, you know, both this renewed focus on racial inequality and this sense of connectedness that came from the shared experience of the pandemic and the lockdowns, where that spirit of, okay, actually, we the people decide, and our country has been, to a degree that, you know, has not been taught to most of us in our schools, our country has been structured in order to create a racial hierarchy, but we don't want it to be. And that spirit is alive and well. And so that makes me really happy and optimistic. And in fact, the next thing I'm going to be writing is a book about solutions and about where communities can go to repair, to heal from the past, to create more equitable structures, looking at so many incredible examples from overlooked places in the U.S. and also places in other societies around the world that have had to deal with how do you come together as a country despite your differences and despite the trauma from factionalism, separatism, racism, war in the past.
So one last question. So I, too, as we were chatting before we started recording, have spent a lot of time with some of these local stories and I think share your sense of hope, again, for the most part. But, you know, as I was doing this work, I'm curious if you share this. It's like you can kind of feel sometimes like you're, am I just burying my head in the sand here? Like I'm around all of this positivity and all these good things happening locally. But meanwhile, if you turn on national news, it's like, democracy is still a dumpster fire, or so it's portrayed. So I wonder how you think about that contradiction.
Well, I do work for and talk about big structural dysfunction, right? I think it's important for us to walk and chew gum at the same time, right? For us to know that these structures that were set up in our society to privilege a small group of people over working and middle-class people of all races, they were made for a reason and they're trying to be upheld by a narrow, self-interested elite. And that's real. And you see that in so much of the policymaking and in so much of the democratic structures that simply are not what our country deserves. But you can't fight for change if the only thing you see is a narrative that says it's always been this way and it's always going to be this way. We need these sources of inspiration like your podcast or The People Decide, like the Some of Us podcast, like the book, that say, actually, throughout history, we've always had people fighting against an economic status quo. We've always had people willing to link arms and do extraordinary things. And those people have usually just been ordinary people. Right, a sharecropper, a seamstress, a preacher, right? Those are the kinds of people who have shaped history for the better. And it's always been a struggle. But I think if we let our media ecosystem be dominated by bad news, then we miss out on the inspiration that can happen for the next incredible leader who is somewhere out there listening for reasons to hope and to get involved.
Heather, that is a fantastic note to end on. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jenna, that was a terrific interview. And yeah, I really enjoyed seeing Heather in person and hearing her again on your interview. Candace, you said that you used this book in your class. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, why? What kind of reviews did you get? What was your thinking?
Yeah, we had a lot of fun. It was a class on racial attitudes in American politics. And, you know, the premise of the class was just to help students recognize how expressions of racial animus evolve over time. And so this book, I thought, really kind of pinged a lot of the goals of that class. The students are Gen Zers and very, you know, this is a generation that really wants to do something and they want to see change. So their reviews were mostly positive, and then there are constructive reviews, I think, or I think they ask it questions. So on the, you know, they really, as I mentioned, were really enthralled by this idea of these beautiful public spaces that don't really exist anymore. So they really took in, you know, the idea that there are ways that people just used to have a different way of thinking about what the role of government and what it is that could be done. So that the kind of trends in public policy and how we moved out of, you know, this great society, New Deal state, which, yes, was completely racialized, but it also, like, in a Aaron Volk democracy, like the parts that were good for white folks, Like, what if we did that for everyone all the time? Like, just it's mind blowing. I think on the other side of their kind of questions they had was, who is this book for? Because it is premised on the idea that racism hurts us all, that drain pool politics hurts us all, right? That filling in the pool means that white folks can't get it, Black folks can't get it. Privatizing schools means that rich white folks can get it, poor white folks and Black folks cannot get certain things. And so, you know, there's something to, like, yes, that is true, but they were just kind of like, well, why does the well-being of white folks have to be centered to make an anti-racist argument? And so we kind of, you know, that's the question of, like, who's the audience of this book? Who are we trying to bring along? But I do think that overall, the idea of the solidarity dividend was something that they wanted to think through. Who is responsible for initiating the work required to make sure that we have cross-racial movements? Who has to do the work, the hard work of bringing along the other group? Who is responsible for cleaning up this mess that we've been living in and that some people have benefited from?
Yeah, I'm really intrigued by their thinking about their surprise that we used to do these things, like that we used to build these pools. And I was thinking of last night, and our listeners will hear this in a few weeks, I'm sure, that we had David Hogg, the young gun rights activist from Parkland, was here. And he's probably a little older than your students, but similar generation. And one thing he kept saying, of course, for him, largely in the context of why we don't have gun control, had to do with this idea: we sent people to the moon. Obviously, we can do this, right? We did this. He was like going back to all these big projects that we had done, and everything. Yes, we have, but these days it really is very difficult to imagine any kind of large public works projects. And think about where the debate has gone in like 3 days around the bridge in Baltimore that. President Biden got out there and, you know, I mean, it's a major port, affects the whole country. And, you know, we got to rebuild this bridge. We're going to rebuild this bridge. And then immediately conservatives like, what's this we business? You know, not our bridge. Why are we going to rebuild this bridge? Let them rebuild their own bridge. And, you know, so the whole idea of interstate highways, of these huge public works projects, we have the obviously technical know-how to do it, but we have lost the political knowledge or what political will to all be able to work together. And the system is so polarized that it's from where I sit, almost impossible to imagine these days. It's sad that our students recognize this, actually, that it is so hard to imagine the country pulling together for large projects anymore.
I think that's the part that's hard to imagine. I think that they can really think through what kind of world they want to live in. They want to live in a world that they can go outside and that, you know, people who live on barrier islands or whatever aren't, you know, their homes aren't going to be brushed over by the next hurricane or tornado or whatever, right? I mean, they have an idea about living in a world where, you know, their younger sisters and brothers don't have to learn what an active shooter drill is and to be nonchalant about it. So the kind of ideas, the imagination is there. It's the how to get there that is the tricky part. Yeah, I mean,
and it's hard to think of large public projects. Either, I mean, I'm sort of moving in the direction of public works, but we're talking more broadly about large public projects that would benefit the public, whether that be climate change or education or anything like that. But it's not in their memory to think of times when that has happened, and the times that it does happen.
I mean, I think, but again, why Heather's book is really important and was good for them is because I think they have a sense of it doesn't have to be like this, but more importantly, it hasn't always been this way. And so that means that there is a way to think through. And, you know, she does give us these examples of when there are successes. I mean, you know, we were just talking about Desmond Mead earlier today before the pod started. But the work that Desmond Mead and his team did in Florida, I think, was unimaginable for many formerly incarcerated people for a very long time. But through grassroots efforts and a lot of hard work, and there still is pushback, but there was a success. And it had to be cross-racial because, you know, you needed many Floridians to get on board to extend the rights of formerly incarcerated people, as an example. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
I guess we're saying the same thing, is that mm-hmm. it is hard. But if we, and this is why Heather's future work is going to be really important, and is to show when things do go well, that we perhaps, maybe we just need more good news more often.
That is a much more upbeat note to end on. Yeah. Well, Candace, this has been a terrifically interesting book to discuss with you from Democracy Works. I'm Michael Berkman.
And I'm Candace Watt-Smith. Thanks for listening.
Democracy Works is a collaboration between the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State and WPSU, Public Media for Central and Northern Pennsylvania. Our producer is Andy Grant, and our editors are Mickey Klein, Chris Kugler, Mark Stitzer, and Clint Yoder. Editorial review by Emily Reddy, and additional support from Christine Allen. Democracy Works is a proud member of the Democracy Group, a podcast network focused on democracy, civic engagement, and civil discourse. Learn more about the network at democracygroup.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.